back to a time when I was in college. The desks were hard. We had no laptops or technology to take notes or exams with. You were writing with a blue book. Anybody old enough to remember a blue book? Yep. So you're writing with your pen and your blue book, and I am taking New Testament 101. I'd been in a lot of Bible studies. I'd grown up in Sunday school. I'd been to church my whole life, and there was one exam question on Bob Patterson's exam for this test. 1 hour. The question was this. If you had to pick one verse of the Bible to introduce a new person to Jesus, what would it be and why? I had an hour. You only get a few moments. Turn to somebody next to you and answer that question. Ready, set, go. So I imagine that there's at least some variety of answers in this room, but I didn't tell you what one of the things it said underneath this question, which was, and the answer cannot be John 3:16. And so I'm working through my mind of all the stuff that we've read, of all the Bible that we've encountered in terms of the New Testament, and particularly the Gospels. If you could only pick one verse, what would it be? Now, I have forgotten a lot about college. It is fascinating to me that I can still picture what it was like sitting at that desk and filling out that essay, and I can still remember my answer. This was my answer, Mark 10:45, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Will you say this out loud with me? For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. This was an open book test. You could work on it with the Bible in your lap. And yet I can still recall what it was like to be challenged in this way. Because again, all the Sunday school classes, all the sermons I had heard, everything, in all of those regards, I was kind of a passive recipient, right? Like you just kind of go to church and you get what you get out of it. You go to a Sunday school class, you get what you get out of it. You go to a Bible study. It's not like that we put tests or exams at the end of this thing. But here was a moment where the script was flipped and all of a sudden I was put in a position where I was now having to do something proactive to explain something in a very simple way to another person. And I remember the conviction that came behind that. And I can still remember the basic outline of my essay, which I want to share with you decades later. Who is Jesus? What'd he do? And why'd he come? Who is Jesus? What did he do? And why did he come? First, let's talk about who Jesus is. Jesus referred to himself in this passage as the Son. It's hard for us to appreciate the full impact of what a son meant in the ancient world. And what I mean by that is that all of your hopes, all of your aspiration, all of your future was tied into having a son. The reason a son, and not just a son or daughter, was because in the ancient world, a son was an heir. The son was the one who could pass on and protect and guarantee. He was your 401k, he was your pension, he was your social security, he was your family name. All of that was tied up in the ability to have a son. And this is the identity of how Jesus tells us and introduces himself over and over again. Who are you? He's the Son. But more often than not, he doesn't just say that he's the Son. He says that he's the Son of something. The most common description of that is that he is the Son of Man or the Son of Humanity. Over 80 times, Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man. In other words, Jesus isn't just any old son. He is the one that all of humanity has been waiting for. He is the heir apparent. He is the one who is to come. And when Jesus describes what the Son of Man will go through, this is how he describes it. The Son of Man will have no rest, no place to rest his head. The Son of Man will be betrayed. The Son of Man will be rejected. The Son of Man will eat with sinners. The Son of Man will forgive sins. The Son of Man will suffer. The Son of Man will die. The Son will be raised from death, come in glory, sit on the throne, sit at the right hand of God, fulfill the promises of all of the prophets, and to seek and to save the lost. Many of you have had the privilege and the honor of what it means to have a child and or a grandchild. When you think of all of the things that Jesus said that his divine vocation was going to entail, would you ever ask for this to be upon a child? Of course not. There are a couple of those things that people expected the Son to do. There were a lot of those things when Jesus said, yes, I am the Son, but this is what I came to do. People were like, no, that's not what the Son does. And yet there was something about Jesus saying that he wasn't just going to be born and go into glory, but the Son came to suffer for us. I want to show you a picture of our youngest daughter, Ashby, when she was younger, back when we used to live in San Antonio, Texas. Ashby loved her stuffed animals. This was her little stuffed animal, Golden Retriever, to be connected with the real Golden Retriever that we had that's on the other side of the prison cell right there. In fact, it is the prison that I wanted to show you. It is a gate that was at the top of our stairs in the home that we built in San Antonio at the top of these stairs. It only took Ashby tumbling down the top of those stairs one time for us to realize, yeah, the gate's probably a good idea. And so we had that gate installed. Upstairs was where the play area was and where our daughter's bedrooms were, and down was where the office was and the kitchen. And so the grown-ups at times were downstairs getting food ready or getting work done, and the kids were upstairs playing. There was no intercom. They didn't have cell phones. There was no other means of communication other than the very primitive form of standing at the top of the stairs like a prisoner through the bars, putting the cup back and forth against the bars, and saying our name. On one particular occasion, Ashby is doing this. She is standing at the top of the stairs, and she's calling out for me. She grabs the sides of the bars, and she yells, Rich! Rich! And I am downstairs, and I turn to look at my wife, and I am like, oh, I wonder where she learned that from. So I go upstairs, I help Ashby with what I don't even remember what it was that I needed to help her with. And then I sat down with her and I explained to her as best as I could, Ashby, I am not offended that you call me my name. That's my name. But there's a lot of people that can call me by name. There's a lot of people that can call me pastor. But there are only two whole people in the world who can call me Papa. You and I have a special relationship, a special name. You get to call me Father. The reason I tell you this is that Jesus came as the Son so that we might be adopted into a larger family. And that it is only through the sonship of Jesus that you and I can call God Father. He came as the Son so that we might have that kind of relationship with God. That's who he is. So what did he do with that? What did Jesus come, if you were to look at his LinkedIn profile with his job description, what does it say that he came to do? Two things. Jesus came to serve, and he came to give. If you need a picture of Jesus as the servant, you can go and see in picture in your mind's eye the image of Jesus wearing a towel around his waist, and he is washing the disciples' feet. Masters didn't have a tendency to wash the feet of their servants. Teachers didn't have a tendency to wash the feet of their students. Kings didn't have a tendency to wash the feet of their subjects. And yet Jesus came to serve them and to serve us. If you need a picture of Jesus giving, look no further than the image of Jesus on the cross. Because you see, Jesus didn't just come to offer a bit of perspective or a bit of help or to offer maybe a little bit of healing to somebody who was in need. No, Jesus came to offer himself, in fact, his whole life. When I got married, one of the first things that I learned that I had to really work through early in marriage was I had to come to terms with how selfish I really was. Scratch that, still am. Still work in progress. I had to go through the understanding of now I'm living with somebody, and I knew that it was my job to put her needs before mine, to make her priorities greater than my priorities. That this is exactly what God had asked of me in being in this relationship. I knew that. It's one thing to know that intellectually. It's another thing entirely to be in a relationship where you have to do that day after day after day. Because it's not like, well, I did that on the day after we are married, but I don't have to do that again. It's a daily surrender. It is a daily commitment to that. Now, what was interesting to me is that was one of the earliest lessons that I learned that I had to try to work through in marriage. It took me longer to realize that it would be easier for me to figure out how to do that in marriage than it was to do something that's related to that. Is, you know, it is still harder for me to allow Kelly to serve me and to give to me than it is for me to allow myself to give and to serve to her. Because there is something in me that doesn't like being vulnerable, that doesn't like being weak, that doesn't like being dependent. I am a self-reliant person that I don't want to be needy. I don't want to be a problem. And so it's taken way longer for me to figure out how to humble myself in such a way where I allow her to be able to serve and to give to me. But if you stick at this thing long enough, eventually life circumstances will break you to the point where that will be necessary. Back when we used to live in California, there was a time where all of a sudden, for the first time, been fortunate to have great health and to not really have any issues, especially anything that required to be corrected by kind of a procedure or a surgery. But after a run, came back one day and discovered, looked in the mirror, I had a double inguinal hernia that had to get fixed. And I mean, really not that big of a deal in the sense of you lay down, you go to sleep, the surgeon fixes it, and you wake up. It's the recovery process that's no fun. And particularly, the pride of the recovery process of that over a month, week after week after week, I can't pick up anything bigger or heavier than a milk jug. Which wouldn't have been its own problem, except for in the sense of that life's really busy and you have things and commitments that you make. Like, we had made a commitment in order to lead a group of people on a pilgrimage, and that we were flying to Istanbul a certain period of time after we had to have this surgery. In addition to going to Istanbul on this trip, Kelly and I were going to go on a vacation that was already prepaid for in the Swiss Alps. So imagine the packing scheme that you need to be able to go to Istanbul, the Greek Isles, and the Swiss Alps all in one trip. That's a lot of clothes. This was not a light packing endeavor. So we fly to Istanbul. We arrive at the airport. My wife, who have you probably seen, is 5'2" and about 100 pounds when she's soaking wet. And we get to baggage claim. And my wife has got these two huge bags, a backpack on her back, a backpack on her chest, and another bag over her arm. And she is walking like this through the airport. What am I doing? I am walking 3 paces in front of her, walking like this. Remember, we're in a predominantly Muslim country, and people are pointing at us and being like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. who is that famous man? I turned to my wife. I said, I cannot tell you how much I am enjoying this right now. But in reality, that was actually hard for me. I was making light of something that was actually painful for me on the inside of that I didn't want to have to be needed in that way. And so that's a challenge. The reason I tell you this is that in my experience and my conversations of people when it comes to Jesus, most people don't have an objection with Jesus when it comes, I have a rational argument, I have an intellectual objection, I've got this issue, or maybe even their own personal experience with Jesus that is an impediment to anything that it comes to the life with Christ. The reason that most people don't want anything to do with Jesus is because in order to accept Jesus, you have to humble yourself enough to admit that Jesus came to serve and to give, and that he's here to serve and to give to you. And that means that you have a need. That means that you're not sufficient on your own. That means that there's something that is missing that you can't fix and that someone else has to do for you. And that is why so many people don't want anything to do with Jesus, because of what it says about our unwillingness to accept help. We have been walking through a series called Overflow. We're discovering what it means to become living water for an empty age. And as we're discovering the way of Jesus, we've been playing with all of these different kinds of practices. We have saved service and generosity for a reason to be our last month before we try to put all this together in November. Our last month of experimenting with disciplines, because this is the job description of Jesus. He came to serve and he came to give. But before you and I figure out how we too need to embrace that job description and we need to serve and we need to give, before we have that happen, we have to come to terms with the fact of that, will you let him serve you? Will you let him give to you? Because I actually don't think that a true life of service and generosity is possible apart from him. And we have to be willing to acknowledge our own needs. Who is Jesus? He's the Son. What did he come to do? He came to serve and to give. Why did he come? For the Son of Man came not to serve, but to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom. Not a word we tend to use too much. Whether it's in the English language, whether you're in a Liam Neeson movie or something along those lines. Only two people got that at the last service, too. I should have quit while I was ahead. But it's actually not even a term that the New Testament uses a whole lot. The word ransom means the price to be able to buy something back. Think pawn shop. To be able to give something its unbinding or its freedom. Here is a picture of a figure from the 1700s. He was actually born in 1700s. His name is Nicholas Zinzendorf. When he was an infant, his father died. He was a part of an aristocratic, very wealthy family. He grew up, and because most people didn't have options to choose what they wanted to be when they grew up in that time period in history, he had options. His family was actually a little disappointed that he didn't go into ministry and that he was going to be a lawyer. And because, like even in today's world, they were a family of means, as he was getting towards the end of college, he had an opportunity to study abroad. And so he got to travel all over Europe. Culture, art, language, food, people. So he's 19 years old. And while he's 19 years old, he goes into the town of Dusseldorf. And he sees and encounters a piece of art. And we know specifically what piece of art it was from an Italian Renaissance painter. And as he looked at this image of Jesus with a crown of thorns on his head, which is kind of muted in colors and faded over the years, there was a series of text in Latin underneath it titled, "Behold the Man," but this is what the painter had put on the text itself. "This have I suffered for you, now what will you do for me?" And for some reason, Nicholas Zinzendorf, in encountering this piece of art, something in him just broke. It broke open. It shattered. And he was mesmerized, and he stayed there looking at this painting. And a resolution began in him that forever changed the rest of his life. That instead of just worldly ambition, he was going to live his life as a service and a generosity towards other people. Towards the end of his life, he said this. He said, "I have been bought at a price. I will live every moment of this day so that the great purchaser of my soul will receive the full reward of his suffering." Zinzendorf is the father of what is known as the Moravian Church. It's actually, he never meant to found a denomination. It was meant to be a renewal movement within the church to try to help the church to truly understand the nature of the gospel and what God has done for us in Jesus. Fast forward 100 years, a little more than 100 years later, there is an English poet who is traveling to Dusseldorf and standing before the very same painting. She's looking at it. We have no idea historically if she had ever heard of Zinzendorf, knew anything about the Moravian movement. But she too was captivated a century later by Jesus with a crown of thorns suffering for her. And because she was a poet, she took out a pen and started writing some words. "Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. Take my moments and my days, let them flow in endless praise. Take my love, my Lord, I pour at thy feet its treasure store. Take myself and I will be ever only all for thee." Now you could say, all right, that's a remarkable piece of art, that it is the catalyst for two people who had a significant impact in their generation upon the gospel and the movement therein. Maybe. But my argument to you would be, I don't think it's the nature of that painting itself so much that did that, but the Spirit of God working through a piece of art in the reminder of that we need to be seeing afresh, once again, in every generation, the nature of the one who paid the ransom so that you could be free. And because probably Italian Renaissance art isn't, you know, the primary way that we express ourselves today, let's do something more contemporary, and let's bring it even closer to home in Atlanta. Do you recognize this artist? This is Steve Penley from Atlanta. And this is the same portrayal, but in more modern terms. And instead of me closing this message with a whole lot of words, I just want you to look into the face of Christ the one who was the son of all humanity, the one who all of the hopes and the aspirations as the heir of all of the covenant promises of God. And he came to suffer. Because it was his job to serve and to give to us. And he didn't just give a little of himself. He gave his all. And the reason he gave is because he was giving to pay a price. One verse. One image. Only one Jesus.